And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we wanted to talk about a question that I had, actually. I was looking back at the list of recent episodes we've covered here on the podcast, and we had a while ago, Andy Crouch. It was a really interesting interview with Andy Crouch, the American writer, about the dangers of smartphones and screens and social media and digital technology in general in the home, and particularly thinking about as parents, those of us with children, how are we kind of protecting our children from some of the harms that there's increasing evidence smartphones might be causing. And then just a few weeks later, we had an episode about solar panels, the energy abundance, and it struck me that we had a radically different take, potentially contradictory take on those two issues. You know, we kind of tended towards the idea that actually modern digital technology, smartphones in particular, can be quite harmful, not just to teenagers, but to everyone. And therefore we shouldn't be afraid as Christians of being quite radical. You know, Andy told that story about his professor friend who has nine children and no one in the house has a mobile phone. There are no screens, there are no TVs, there are no computers. And how Andy himself has a rule about, you know, no screens until you're 16, and they Sabbath one day a week, one week a month, one month a year. You know, what to us in our 20th century world seems quite radical. You know, you even described it as kind of neo-Luddism. And at the same time, with the solar panels, the argument seemed to be, this is a blessing from God. This is about how humans taking control of God's creation and reformulating it in a way that extracts all his goodness. Let's lean in hard. Let's get excited. Let's, create more and more energy that we can possibly know what to do with. Let's carpet the Sahara with solar panels. This is brilliant. Are those in contradiction? Can we be Luddites about smartphones but boosterists about solar panels at the same time?
It's a good question. I think it illustrates how this very word technology is a very slippery word, because, you know, all it really means is things that human beings make. And it is true that there is this movement, which is sometimes called neo-Luddism, you know, that a general view that modern technology is bad and is the source of all evil, and a kind of romantic going back to a previous era. But I think there's a fundamental problem with that as a sweeping concept. And the first problem is that even this romantic pre-technological era is in fact got its own technology. It's, you know, so the plow, the horse that's drawing it, the spade, the hoe, the, you know, planting, all the things of an agricultural economy is all technology.
Yeah. The house,
exactly.
The wheel,
exactly.
The window.
So in other words, this idea that technology, that the things that human beings make are in themselves bad and restrict human development, human flourishing, you know, simply doesn't work. And I think therefore we need to be more thoughtful and sophisticated about what we mean by technology, that some kinds of technology are clearly beneficial and good. Some things that human beings make really help us to be more human. And some things that human beings make can be really damaging. But the other thing, which I, you know, as a pediatrician, I often feel I would really like to talk to some make this point to neo-Luddites, and that is, you know, what the benefits that health technology has brought, and in particular in its unbelievable reduction in maternal and childhood mortality. And, you know, would you really want to go back to a pre-technological era, which would mean that you would watch your wife with a very substantial risk of dying in the next childbirth, and you're going to watch a significant proportion of your children die in front of your eyes of untreatable diseases? Is that really a kind of human flourishing that you are longing for? You know, because people have this very over-romanticized concept of what a pre-technological era might be like. And most people would say, oh, no, we want the healthcare, and we want the good, you know, clean water and proper sewers and so on, but we just don't want smart
car.
And so I think we just have to recognize that the different things that human beings make are different. The problem with a smartphone is not the fact that you can have a phone with the most amazing capability, that, you know, that this little black box has GPS so I can know where I am on the planet. It has the possibility to talk to anyone else on the planet. It has the possibility to find any information about the planet. That's a wonderful thing, which opens up human flourishing. The problem with a smartphone is that it has been weaponized. It has been deliberately created to become a tool of addiction, in order to enable some very rich people make more money by selling adverts and attention. And so the problem is not the smartphone as per se. The problem is what the smartphone represents if you give it to a teenager, this thing that's designed to be like digital heroin and which is a conduit for all the snake oil merchants in the world, and the disinformation merchants and so on, and the influencers to get at you. So, I think there are very good reasons to try and say there's something deeply wrong about that whole infrastructure, the way the smartphone is used, has been designed, the way the software, you know, the what's often called surveillance capitalism, all that stuff. There's actually another phrase. Have we talked about this before? Limbic capitalism. So the limbic system is the bit of your brain that is all about desire,
reward centers,
and reward. And the idea is that capitalism is constantly hacking our limbic centers in order to sell us stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's what's wrong. So when we come to the solar panel, and it seems to me, well, of course, there are bad things about solar panels, that, you know, they don't look very nice and that they take up space in green fields and so on. But the positive thing that you have an unlimited supply of clean electricity seems to, from my perspective, massively outweigh the negative. So in other words, I think this Luddite or techno-optimist spectrum is far too simplistic. We need a much more nuanced and thoughtful understanding that technology is often to do with mastery, with power, and it's all about who has the power, who's in control. I was part of a discussion just yesterday about artificial intelligence, and somebody who works as a technologist in a big company says that he teaches his children, you know, who is controlling this and what are they trying to do with you. So, you know, when you go onto Facebook, it's probably Mark Zuckerberg who is trying to get you to do something. And when you go onto Google, it's going to be, you know, the Google.
No, I think they just want to organize all the world's information and not be evil, Dad. I'm pretty sure that's what Google's all about.
All right. I must have got that wrong then somewhere. You know, so it's this kind of teaching your children to be much more aware of the hidden traps, addictions, motivations that are presented as this beautifully attractive, wonderful, endlessly fascinating device.
Okay, well, let's try and finesse it then. So clearly we're not, you know, even the Christians like Andy Crouch, who are, you know, hostile to smartphones, are not pretending that all technology is bad. But let's talk about energy abundance. You know, we talked about how great it would be if we could generate 10 or 100 times more electricity than we do currently through these ever cheaper solar panels. But what is that electricity going to be used for? It's going to be used to feed into the industry that gave us the smartphone. It's going to be used to power up the next generation of Meta and Google and Huawei and, you know, Samsung. And these are the very companies that have become, you know, the most successful, profitable companies of all time, squatting over our economies, dominating national governments in their power and influence. And they are companies powered by what? Electricity. And the semiconductor. And do we really, like, can we really say it's an unalloyed good? It's God's blessing. It's bringing water out of barren deserts if we turbocharge this industry.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good point, of course. But that's true of everything, isn't it? That it's always possible for evil human beings to take good things that God gives to us and turn them into something that's evil. And you know, the armaments and the military industrial complex is a even better example. But, you know, as we talked before, that energy, which is so cheap, can be being used to bring light to dark villages across the large areas of the world that has no light. It's to bringing clean water out of wherever there's seawater, and to powering hospitals and healthcare so that more children can be saved from dying and getting decent healthcare. So from I think the Christian perspective says that the forces of good, God's power, God's beneficence, far outweighs what the evil one can do, far outweighs the evil potential. And so in general, rather than say, oh, it's all very dangerous, we should go back, I think a robust creation theology says, you know, let's take the abundance that is there and let's use it in a godly way. That it's not an accident that God has given us just an almost unlimited quantities of energy. And therefore, whereas previously the kind of green agenda did seem an extremely sort of parsimonious,
puritanical, you know, even.
Puritanical. We must basically all learn to live simply so that other people may simply live, because it's a Malthusian basic argument. There are too many mouths. There's too much pollution. There's not enough rare earths. There's not enough. And we must all just slim down and reduce our existence. I think all the evidence tends towards in the other direction, that in fact there are almost unlimited resources. Not completely. I mean, but rare earths is a really interesting example. Now, these are chemicals which are in relatively short supply and which are essential to modern digital technologies. It's always been predicted that we're going to run out of these essential chemicals. There are simply not enough on, you know, to fund the industry. And lo and behold, the more valuable any chemical becomes, any mineral, the more effort is put into finding it and extracting it, and it turns out the more there is. And also the more it's recycled, so that now the recycling of these rare earths has become a major industry. So there's absolutely no evidence that we're going to run out of these precious commodities. Yeah, we're going to run out of oil, but we don't need oil. The oil can stay in the ground. And so it seems to me providentially God is giving the human race extraordinary potential to develop and use the good things that he's created. And rather than, so my position, therefore, is rather than start with the Luddite, it's all very dangerous, let's just limit our ideas to the minimum, is to a default position of, if it seems possible to use these things for good, we should do that, we should grasp them, whilst at the same time recognising the possibility of evil. So what's the answer to the people using electricity for terrible purposes? Answer, we've got to regulate them. I mean, we can't have a free-for-all. There's too much evil around. We can't have laissez-faire capitalism where, you know, the billionaire, a few billionaires, unelected, control and dominate the world's economy. We simply must find ways democratically of exerting power to ensure that the common good is being protected. It's the tragedy of the commons, is often said, isn't it, that you can't leave just to market forces. You must protect the defences. And certainly, from a Christian point of view, that's a very strong theme, isn't it? Widows, orphans and aliens and immigrants, these are the vulnerable individuals in Israeli society. These are the ones that have to be protected and cared for.
Hence, God builds into the structures, you know, when you glean, don't go to the edge of your fields, you know, contrary to the market preferences. And, you know, the rational thing to do if you're a farmer is to take all the crops, but God doesn't leave some behind. I guess the rebuttal to that, or the next question would be, yes, you talked about regulation and not wanting it to be a free for all, but you want to start on a position of kind of optimism and hopefulness. Isn't that to kind of willfully ignore human history, which says that every time we have untapped more power, more of God's beneficence, we've always used it to harm people? You know, we figure out how to split the atom. And what do? We use it to build enough nuclear missiles to kill everyone on Earth 14 times over. We discover the power of dynamite, which Nobel thought would end all wars, and actually, you know, we use it to launch industrialized killing in World War II. Like, the truth is that all the evidence tells us that when human beings do manage to fully tap the power of the sun and create energy abundance, we'll use that energy to do terrible things to each other with it, because that's what we've always done in the past. And so I'm not saying we should stop, but let's not be naive about it. Let's not be giddy about the future. The future could be quite a dark one.
Yeah, and you know, I hear that, but again, I think it's that's hopelessly over pessimistic, because even the examples you gave, well, certainly for nuclear power, I've absolutely, you know, you could show the evidence is that nuclear power has saved thousands of times more lives than it has destroyed. You know, even with the tragedies of Hiroshima. So, you know, if you look at the graphs showing the extraordinary improvements in maternal mortality, in life expectancy, in pediatric mortality, and so on. I mean, people have never been healthier. There's a complete mismatch between perceptions. If you ask people, do surveys, people would say, yeah, there are probably more people dying of infectious diseases and plague, and there are more people living in poverty than there were 10 years ago. The actual objective evidence is exactly the opposite. There is far less poverty, people living in poverty, than there used to be 10 years ago, and 10 years ago, far less than 20 years ago. So,
and yet at the same time, more people died in the 20th century than the preceding 19 combined from violence between humans.
And that is true. And
we don't believe in progress as Christians, do we?
Well, I think we do. I do. I believe in material progress, and which I think is the fulfillment of the creation mandates, and that science and technology is part of the way in which we are subduing the earth and bringing forth its potential and cultivating the garden, which are our creation mandates. So,
but there's no promise that that's going to be a linear upward trend. It's very plausible that the year before Christ eventually returns is the worst year for humans rather than the best year for humans. There's absolutely no reason in scripture I see why we couldn't fail our creation mandate and fall so far short that we end up, you know, doing so much more abusive, destructive power through God's creation than as stewards we were intended to.
It's interesting, isn't it? I, of course, theoretically that's right, but I think that is to give to human, puny human beings, far too much agency, far too much autonomy. That is really the secular idea, that we create the future through our choices. You know, that the future is undeveloped and it's up to us. And if we make bad choices, we're going to create Armageddon. And I think the biblical picture is much more like the future is this extraordinary river of God's providence, which started before the foundation of the world and is going on to the new heavens and the new earth. And human beings have actually quite limited autonomy in the direction of that river or its final outcome. God's purposes and plans are going to be revealed. And one of the biblical themes is that even human evil turns out to be fulfilling God's providences. Mm. And therefore, in that sense, it seems to me that God's purposes for this age is... appears to be bringing greater material prosperity, bringing, as we talked about before, bringing streams in the desert and the healing to the blind and feeding the hungry. And it could be that there are terrible reversals to come. It could be, but there seems to be something about the way that science and technology works, which is, it's irreversible. We're not going to forget about antibiotics. We're not going to forget about solar panels. We're not going to forget about how to heal sick people. And isn't that part of God's providence?
Before we get back to this episode, I just want to take a moment to remind you that this podcast is only possible thanks to the support of listeners like you, which makes your gift today so important. That's why, to thank you for your generous gift today, I'd like you to have a copy of a new ebook from N.T. Wright called What Do We Mean by Heaven? The Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture. This new ebook offers profound biblical answers to questions about salvation, the resurrection, the afterlife, and the rapture. As you uncover the important answers, you'll also be encouraged and challenged to find peace and hope in the deep mysteries of life. Again, it's our thanks to you for your gift to help more people live as confident, informed Christians. To give your gift and download your copy of N.T. Wright's ebook, What Do We Mean by Heaven, the Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Maybe. I guess I see echoes of that, but then I also think, you know, so much of the biblical imagery around, you know, where we're going is apocalyptic, right? Is, you know, Revelation and Daniel, there is the and I'm not saying I don't believe any of this is literal, you know, I don't have a kind of strictly millennialist approach to any of this stuff, but I'm just saying the theme and the language is about strife and contest and struggle and human empires rising and falling and cannibalizing each other. And then in the end of times, there's this great consummation and the Prince of Peace descends and brings a stop to it all. So there is another version of the human story which says they're absolutely right. God's purposes cannot be interfered with by puny humans, and whether we choose to be horrible to each other is not going to change the ultimate end point, which is a remade world full of peace and life and joy and no tears and all that stuff. But I don't see any reason why it'd be unchristian to believe that in the preceding millennia before that point things could get really quite dicey. And things could be, there could be conflict and war and trial and famine and strife. It's not going to be, we're not necessarily going to be, like, we don't get to heaven incrementally. We're not rebuilding the Tower of Babel, but through our power and technology and saying, once we've got, you know, the world 99% perfect, Jesus will come back to do the final 1%. That's not the Christian story at all, is it?
Well, it's interesting, you know, in 2,000 years of history and 2,000 years of Christian reading of those texts, there have been many different ways of interpreting that apocalyptic literature. And what has become in these last few decades of church history the dominant way of reading that is what was often called a premillennial an understanding of Revelation, that this is a historical description of the end times, and at the end times haven't got there yet. All this is to come, and it's going to end up, as you say, with this sort of cataclysmic opposition between good and evil, terrible disaster, and then there's the inauguration. Christ appears, and there is the inauguration of the new heaven and the new earth. That has become a dominant way of reading it, but particularly promoted by American fundamentalists, I think, in the 20th century. But my understanding, and I'm by no means an expert at this, is that if you look back over the 20th centuries, there have been many other different interpretations. And in fact, this premillennial reading has been the minority. This is a relatively minority view, and that many previous Bible readers and scholars have interpreted this differently as being a description of what we are currently in, not some apocalyptic future. Or possibly something even describing what was happening in the early years of Christianity. So I think this understanding that this is a historical description of what is yet to come has never been universally held. And there are the other scriptures, as we, you know, like Isaiah 35, of these wonderful descriptions of the coming age, which don't refer to some terrible apocalyptic disaster, but they refer to a growing, you know, the appearance, the pilgrims making their way back to the holy city and being on the way and everything blossoming around them. You know, they've been on this long journey, and at last they are meeting, and amazingly, as they go, everything is blossoming around them. A kind of progressive development into the new heaven and the new earth. So I don't know. But I do believe that we have to read the Bible through the lens of what is happening in the modern world. Everybody's always tried to understand the Bible in the light of what is happening. And to me, these extraordinary changes that we're living through, that the world has never seen before, in terms of improvements in healthcare, mortality, lifestyle, longevity, and everything else, must in some way relate to the bigger Christian story. And so the question is, well, how do they? I think what you're suggesting is they're completely irrelevant. They're just a kind of strange kind of blip that's happened before the evil one really gets going and destroys the whole lot. And I'm saying, I just think you're giving the evil one far too much credit there.
It's not quite what I'm saying. I guess I'm a cynic, as I've made clear on this podcast many times. And I look back through history and I see so many periods when Christians and others have identified themselves as living in or moving into some golden age of bounty and progress, or even fulfillment and consummation. You know, I was listening to a podcast recently about the late 900s, and people got very excited about the first millennium and this idea that, you know, this was going to be it. And, you know, and it's peaks and troughs. You know, we have bursts of explosions of fecundity and progress, and then the Black Death arrives, and one in three people in Europe is killed overnight in a year. And it takes centuries to recover, you know, and then we hit the Industrial Revolution and we have this incredible uptick, and then we have two world wars, you know, or there's a pandemic comes on, you know. I don't see any linear progress. I see peaks and troughs. I see bad times, good times. And I think I'm wary of being of ascribing to, we might be going up a peak now, of ascribing this to have kind of a historical cosmic spiritual significance when it, in 100 years' time, taking the long historical view, there's every chance that we're looking back, coming down into the trough and go, no, that was just one of those peaks and troughs. And history grinds on without any real movement towards any particular place, because God's going somewhere, but human beings, we're just going around in circles.
But it's patently obvious that's not the case. Over 2,000 years, we are not going around in circles. That all the graphs go in one direction. Yes, they go up and down, but they're all going in one direction. And so it's an Eastern monism that says history is cyclical. It was always thus, and it was the same. And Christian understanding is no, history has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a direction. And how do we discern that? Well, Jesus says, read the sign of the times. And that means watching what's going on, thinking about it, discerning, seeing what the direction of history is. And on the broader perspective about the whole development of knowledge, science, communication, technology, health, we are not going around in circles. And so I don't know, I don't claim to know what the significance of it all is, but I think it would be a mistake, and it would be even, you know, ungodly to have an overly pessimistic, why are we giving the evil one such power when absolutely when nothing can happen without God's providential purposes. And yes, it's possible that the whole thing is destroyed in a terrible conflagration and that all the progress of science is destroyed. But I don't feel we should be basing our planning on that likelihood. I think we should be trying to be wise stewards, and as said before, trying to follow the creation mandates, which God has called us to do even before the fall. After the fall, they're still there. We're called to subdue, to fulfill his purposes for the creation in which, and that's part of being made in the image of God, that we're called to rule over the creation, not to dominate or abuse, but to take responsibility for the position which we've been put in on this planet.
Okay, and circling back round to what we started this conversation with, is this fundamentally a pro or anti-technology podcast?
Well, it sounds like it's a kind of Manichaean podcast where I'm the booster.
And I'm the Luddite. I guess I agree with your fundamental point, which is that technology in itself can't be simply castigated as all good or all bad. It has to be addressed more thoughtfully and more carefully, as by Christians, to try and say, you know, the solar panel, I think, is a good thing, that we can turn sunlight into electricity, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the way the solar industry could develop and the implications that could flow from it are therefore always going to be good. And in the same way, the smartphone, I think, is a good thing, but clearly can also cause tremendous harm in the wrong hands and at the wrong time and used unhealthily and sinfully. And so there's no shortcuts here. You know, we can't go and be Amish, and we can't go and sign up to Peter Thiel's techno-optimist supervision. We have to do the hard work of addressing each one on a case-by-case basis and thinking carefully before we throw in our lot with any particular piece of technology.
Yes, absolutely right. But fundamentally, we have been placed in this planet and in this creation with the most extraordinary potential. And we have been called to draw out that potential. You know, back to that picture of the gardener who is taking the raw material that God has provided, but is then out of their own creativity generating the most extraordinary beauty and order and wonder, which was always there, inherent. And medicine, you see, was always there. The poppy was always making a chemical which just happens to tap into the pain receptors in the human brain. But it's taken thousands of years to work out how to extract it, how to control it, how to use it for maximum good. So we are taking the potential that's inherent within God's good creation and using it for good.
And as we discussed in the episode, you know, countless billions of watts of power have been washing onto this earth from the sun for hundreds of millions of years. And we've only just now started to tap into an infinitesimal fraction of that and see that we can use that power to turn it into something really productive and constructive.
Yeah. And from a Christian perspective, is that an accident? No. Is that irrelevant to God's plans and purposes for this planet? Probably no.
Okay, well, we should probably call it to a close there. Thanks for everyone for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this question. You know, what should the Christian posture to be towards technology? Are we fundamentally pro? Are we anti? Is that the wrong kind of framing of the question? Please do send in your questions, your feedback, your comments. We'd love to hear it. Molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And you can also go to Dad's website. That's John Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T.com. Where there's lots of interesting things to read, listen to, and watch. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.